KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now.
When we think about vaccine-preventable illnesses, they're only preventable if we have adequate vaccination rates. And as we see those rates start to decline, you know, across the nation, then we'll see more outbreaks.
As a measles outbreak grows in West Texas, an unvaccinated child has died. In the first reported measles death in the United States in over a decade. Yet the nation's new health secretary, vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr., says the outbreak is not unusual. We'll go to Texas to speak with pediatrician Dr. Peter Hotez. Then, as President Trump holds his first cabinet meeting, we look at the role of budget director, Project 2025 author Russell Vogt. We'll speak to Jacobin's Branko Marcicic, who says Vogt is trying to reshape the government so it benefits just the rich. Then Lebanon after Nasrallah. We'll air a special report from the ground in Lebanon by Democracy Now! And Drop Set News correspondent Sharifa Belkadus.
We're standing here on the rubble of one of the homes. There's hardly any structures that have been left standing. The Israeli military left here just 3 days ago, occupying the village for several months. Residents were trying to get back to their homes, were protesting on the outskirts, but there's hardly anyone here because there's nothing to come back to.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House has put in motion plans for its largest wave of federal layoffs. In a memo sent to government agencies on Wednesday, the Office of Management and Budget and the Office of Personnel Management said departments should prepare for major reductions in force over the next 2 weeks. The order exempts postal workers, military personnel, political appointees, and immigration and law enforcement jobs. Since coming to office, the Trump administration's laid off tens of thousands of probationary workers, put workers on administrative leave, pushed others to prematurely resigned by offering buyouts and imposing a return to office policy. Trump also moved on Wednesday to expand Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, requiring government contracts, grants, and loans come under a centralized payment system that will be overseen by DOGE. President Trump touted his plans for more layoffs as he held his first cabinet meeting Wednesday. Trump asked Elon Musk to address the meeting first, even though Musk is not a cabinet member. Wearing a T-shirt that read tech support, Musk berated government workers who failed to respond to his email demanding an accounting of their recent work accomplishments. Meanwhile, Trump announced more plans to slash government agencies, including the EPA and the Education Department.
I spoke with Lee Zeldin, and he thinks he's going to be cutting 65% or so of the people from environmental, and we're going to speed up the process too at the same time. You had a lot of people that weren't doing their job. They were just obstructionists, and a lot of people that didn't exist, I guess, Lee, too. You found a lot of empty spots that the people weren't there. They didn't exist. I think education is going to be one of those. You go around Washington, you see all these buildings for the Department of Education. We want to move education back to the states where it belongs.
In more EPA news, Administrator Lee Zeldin's calling for a repeal of the 2009 endangerment finding, which classifies greenhouse gases as a public health threat and allows for climate regulations. At Wednesday's cabinet meeting, Trump also said he's planning a 25% tariff on goods from the European Union. In Washington, D.C., the People's Action Institute led protests Wednesday outside the headquarters of Blackstone, United Health, and American Gas Association. All three stand to benefit from the GOP budget framework passed Tuesday, which would shower tax cuts on the wealthy while slashing essential services like Medicaid.
Use our taxpayer dollars for our health care, yes. For our housing, yes. And
to transition away from fossil fuels.
Meanwhile, inside the Capitol, dozens of AIDS activists and fired USAID workers staged a die-in at the rotunda of the Cannon Congressional Office Building as they chanted, quote, Congress has blood on its hands, unfreeze aid now, unquote. The protest came hours before the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to miss a court-ordered midnight deadline to release more than $1.5 billion in frozen foreign aid payments. In Sudan, the freeze on U.S. aid has forced up to 80% of emergency food kitchens or about 1,100 facilities to close, exacerbating Sudan's food crisis. The BBC quotes one aid worker who said the cuts left people, quote, screaming from hunger in the streets, unquote. Separately, the World Food Program has temporarily halted aid distribution in North Darfur's Zamzam camp due to intensified fighting between Sudan's army and RSF paramilitary forces. On Wednesday, a senior UN aid official briefed the Security Council on Sudan's crisis.
Nearly 2 years of relentless conflict in Sudan have inflicted immense suffering and turned parts of the country into a hellscape. Some of the humanitarian dimensions of this crisis bear repeating. More than 12 million people displaced, including 3.4 million people who have fled across Sudan's borders. More than half of the country, 24.6 million people, experiencing acute hunger.
The World Health Organization warns an outbreak of an unidentified illness in the Democratic Republic of Congo has spread to more than 419 cases and caused at least 53 deaths. The disease causes symptoms consistent with hemorrhagic fever, can kill within 48 hours of symptom onset, and has a fatality rate of over 12%. The outbreak is believed to have started in a village where three young children died after consuming a bat carcass. Israel's released more than 600 Palestinian prisoners after Hamas handed over the remains of four Israeli hostages as part of the Gaza ceasefire deal. Al Jazeera reports Israel's delayed the release of 46 Palestinian prisoners, including 24 children from Gaza. Many of the newly freed prisoners showed clear signs of torture, starvation, severe medical neglect. This is a freed prisoner, Ayad al-Saudi, speaking from Khan Yunis.
Praise be to God. We feel great, but the joy is not complete. Why? Because there are young men who are still imprisoned and suffering. The period of captivity was not just being held captive. It was torture, torture beyond description.
The Palestinian Health Ministry reports hospitals across Gaza have received the bodies of 17 people killed by Israeli attacks over the last 48 hours, despite the ceasefire. Meanwhile, Israel's armies ordered its forces to remain in the Philadelphia corridor separating Gaza from Egypt. On Wednesday, President Donald Trump provoked outrage when he posted an AI-generated video to his Truth Social platform, depicting his plan to expel Palestinians from Gaza and to turn it into the Riviera of the Middle East. The video shows Gaza as a luxury beach resort with skyscrapers, palm trees, and a golden statue of Trump. Elon Musk makes several appearances, as does a shirtless Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's depicted sipping cocktails with Trump on a Gaza beach. Palestinians reacted to Trump's video with disgust and indignation.
Since 1948, they've been trying to displace Palestinians. The people are clinging to their land and their homeland because this is the land of their fathers and grandfathers. And this is the land in which the Blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque is located. We reject any operation or any thought of displacement.
Russian diplomats are meeting their U.S. counterparts in Istanbul for talks on normalizing diplomatic missions 3 years after the Biden administration withdrew U.S. embassy staff from Russia as Vladimir Putin ordered the invasion of Ukraine. A U.S. embassy official in Turkey said Ukraine is not on the agenda at the talks. The Istanbul meeting comes ahead of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's trip to Washington, D.C., where he's due to meet President Trump at the White House Friday to sign an agreement giving U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals and other resources. On Wednesday, Trump refused to commit to significant security guarantees as part of the deal.
Well, I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much. We're going to have Europe do that.
Following Trump's remarks, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer warned Russia could re-invade Ukraine unless the U.S. commits to security guarantees. Starmer's in Washington today for talks at the White House, where he's expected to ask Trump to commit to a British-French-led peacekeeping force for a post-war Ukraine. In Kyiv, President Zelensky said a draft agreement had restored some language on future security guarantees.
Of course, this agreement is about economics, but I ask for there to be at least an understanding that we are seeing things the same way, that all of it is part of future security guarantees. So even in the framework agreement, I wanted for there to be at least a sentence, security guarantees for Ukraine. As far as I was briefed by the government officials, this sentence is there now.
The oil giant BP has announced it's cutting planned investments in clean energy and redirecting that spending towards fossil fuels to the tune of $10 billion per year. The climate group 350.org said the news, quote, clearly demonstrates why super rich corporations and individuals chasing short-term profit for themselves and shareholders cannot be trusted with fixing the climate crisis or leading the transition to renewable energy we so badly need, they said. A new study published in the journal Nature finds glaciers are melting at an accelerating rate, causing a major rise in sea levels, 2 centimeters this century alone. Over the past decade, over one-third more ice melted than the previous decade. Rising sea levels are leading to increasingly severe flooding for hundreds of millions of people in coastal communities. In West Texas, an unvaccinated child's died from measles, the first known U.S. measles death in a decade. There have been at least 124 cases in West Texas, 9 in New Mexico in the current outbreak. Many of the cases are centered in a Mennonite community known for having lower vaccination rates. This is Laura Johnson, Chief Medical Officer of Covenant Health in Texas.
We were confident that we'd eradicated measles from the United States and had really gotten to a point where we just didn't see these kinds of outbreaks happening. Obviously, that has changed over the last 20-something years. And so we do see outbreaks more frequently, but that is related to how much we're vaccinating our population.
At the White House, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. downplayed the outbreak, calling it not unusual. We'll have more on this story after headlines. A new Pentagon memo is calling for the identification and removal of transgender military members over the next 2 months. Some transgender personnel may receive exemptions, according to the memo, which was issued late Wednesday in response to a lawsuit challenging Trump's January executive order to ban transgender troops. President Trump's announced plans to sell a $5 million so-called gold card visa, granting U.S. residency and a path to citizenship. Legal experts say the move likely requires congressional approval. When asked by a reporter if Russian oligarchs could purchase U.S. citizenship, Trump responded possibly, adding, quote, I know some Russian oligarchs that are very nice people, unquote. In other immigration news, the Trump administration transported at least another 9 immigrant prisoners to the Guantanamo military base in Cuba Tuesday. At least 3 lawsuits have been filed against the transfers. In the UK, over 500 prominent media and entertainment figures signed on to a letter condemning the BBC for pulling the documentary Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone, from its streaming service. The move from BBC came after complaints by pro-Israel activists that the film about Gazan youth is narrated by the 14-year-old son of a deputy agriculture minister in Gaza's Hamas government. The protest letter states, quote, this broad brush rhetoric assumes that Palestinians holding administrative roles are inherently complicit in violence, a racist trope that denies individuals their humanity and right to share their lived experiences, unquote. Here in New York, students at Barnard and Columbia University are taking part in a sick-out today to protest the expulsion of 2 Barnard students for participating in a Palestinian rights protest that allegedly disrupted a class called History of Modern Israel. On Wednesday, dozens of students took over a floor of Barnard College, dispersing only after Barnard's administration agreed to meet with them today. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul is under fire after ordering CUNY, the City University of New York, immediately remove a job posting for a Palestinian studies professor at Hunter College. The job listing called for a, quote, historically grounded scholar who takes a critical lens to issues pertaining to Palestine, including but not limited to settler colonialism, genocide, human rights, apartheid, migration, climate and infrastructure devastation, health, race, gender, and sexuality, unquote. Governor Hochul said the post was anti-Semitic after complaints by Zionist groups. And in media news, The Washington Post's opinion editor David Shipley resigned Wednesday after billionaire owner Jeff Bezos announced op-eds would start focusing on personal liberties and free markets. It's the latest sign of turmoil at the paper, coming 4 months after The Washington Post declined to make a presidential endorsement, leading thousands of readers to cancel their subscriptions. Former Washington Post columnist Margaret Sullivan wrote, quote, it's all about getting on board with Trump. Bezos no longer wants to own an independent news organization. He wants a megaphone and a political tool that'll benefit his own commercial interests, she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Texas, where an unvaccinated child has died of measles. It's the first reported measles death in the United States in a decade. The child's death in a hospital in Lubbock, West Texas, comes as the largest measles outbreak in the state in over 30 years is now spreading to New Mexico. Since it began late last month, 124 people have contracted the disease, most of them unvaccinated children. On Thursday, the newly appointed head of Health and Human Services vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called the death not unusual. During the White House cabinet meeting, he told reporters, we have measles outbreaks every year.
Following the measles epidemic every day, I think there's 124 people who have contracted measles at this point, mainly in Gaines County, Texas, mainly, we're told, in the Mennonite community. There are two people who have died, we're watching it, and there are about 20 people hospitalized, mainly for quarantine. We're watching it. We put out a post on it yesterday, and we're going to continue to follow it. Incidentally, there have been 4 measles outbreaks this year in this country. Last year, there were 16. So it's not unusual. We have measles outbreaks every year.
Correcting RFK Jr.'s claims of 2 deaths, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services later clarified only 1 person had died of the measles outbreak. Although Kennedy said that people were being hospitalized mainly for quarantine, local health officials say that's not the case. Dr. Laura Johnson, a chief medical officer at the Lubbock Hospital, said patients have been hospitalized for respiratory issues.
We were confident that we'd eradicated measles from the United States and had really gotten to a point where we just didn't see these kinds of outbreaks happening. Obviously, that has changed over the last 20-something years. And so we do see outbreaks more frequently, but that is related to how much we're vaccinating our population.
For more, we're joined from Houston, Texas, by Peter Hotez, internationally recognized physician, pediatrician, scientist on neglected tropical diseases and vaccine development. He's co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine, the author of several books, including The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning, and Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Scientists. He also wrote the book, Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, My Journey as a Vaccine Scientist, Pediatrician, and Autism Dad. Dr. Hotez, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can start off responding to what is happening in West Texas, how unusual is this child's death?
Well, it's devastating, right, Amy? Because this is a school-aged child who was denied access to the MMR vaccine, was unvaccinated. This is a death that never had to happen. And the problem is there could be additional deaths. I hope not, but you know, those kids in the hospital are there for a reason because they're sick. You know, if you look at what happens when an unvaccinated child gets measles, on average, 20% require hospitalizations, usually because of respiratory illness, as was mentioned in this instance, because of measles pneumonia. It's a giant cell pneumonia that's very devastating, often requires an ICU admission. And that's just the beginning. Then there's dehydration from measles diarrhea. There's neurologic involvement, encephalitis, deafness, hearing loss, and the list goes on. And so I think the message that we really need to understand is measles is a serious illness. In the 1980s, 3 million kids died every year from measles. It was the single leading killer of children globally. Now, through the Gavi Alliance, the Global Alliance of Vaccines and Immunization, we brought it down to 100,000 deaths, still a lot of deaths. But our vaccine ecosystem is very fragile because measles is so highly transmissible. The minute you stop vaccinating and maintaining that vigilance of 90-95% vaccine coverage, measles comes roaring back, and that's what's happened here in West Texas.
I mean, there were so many inaccuracies in what RFK Jr. said, among them that the people who are in the hospital are mainly there for isolation, and yet you have the doctors saying it's respiratory distress. Can you explain what happens to the body?
Yeah, what happens is when you become infected with the measles virus, and if 10 unvaccinated kids are exposed to the virus, 9 will acquire the infection. That's how contagious it is. And then what happens is you get a prodrome of what we used to call the 3 C's, cough, coryza, which means upper respiratory involvement and congestion, conjunctivitis, followed by the rash. And the rash is occurring because the virus is getting into the bloodstream and disseminating to the skin in all parts of the body. And unfortunately, that includes what we call hematogenous spread to the lungs, and it causes a very damaging pneumonitis and pneumonia, and then can also result in encephalitis and other involvement. And so that's what's happening to these kids. These are very sick kids. And unfortunately, you know, the official number is around 124. I think there's many more kids who are still getting diagnosed or who are escaping medical attention. And the numbers will continue to accelerate. This thing is still on a steep climb, and the numbers will continue to accelerate, and so unfortunately will the hospitalizations.
The chair of the Senate Health Committee that confirmed Kennedy is a doctor from Louisiana. And he was a major promoter of vaccines when he was a doctor. He famously talks about one kid at 18 who was medevaced, will spend the rest of her life dealing with what happened because she wasn't vaccinated. But then in Louisiana, they ended promoting mass vaccinations. Can you talk about what's happening in Texas? And who are the communities, these unvaccinated communities, like the Mennonites, who are not necessarily anti-vaccine, Dr. Hotez?
That's absolutely right. There's no religious prohibitions against vaccinations, really, in just about any religion, but including the Mennonite community. So I think what we're hearing is an anti-vaccine activist kind of got to them, and they're an insular, relatively insular group, and therefore they were able to operate. And that's what these anti-vaccine groups do. They're highly predatory. They target groups with disinformation. And unfortunately, our anti-vaccine lobby here is very aggressive. It really started accelerating around 10 years ago. Using a lot of health freedom, medical freedom, what I call propaganda, and the consequence of that is they lobby elected officials, and the consequence of that is we now have over 100,000 kids with whose parents have filed personal belief exemptions in the state of Texas, and this doesn't even count the many, many homeschooled kids. So this is like the metaphor I like to use, it's like the warm waters of the Caribbean right before a hurricane hits. And the reason why the hurricane accelerates is the warm waters of the Caribbean. And in this case, the warm waters are this huge unvaccinated cohort of kids and adults in West Texas and other parts of Texas as well, East Texas. And so that's why I think this is going to be relatively easy for the measles virus, unfortunately, to spread among those unvaccinated populations.
So what has to happen right now, Dr. Hotez? What has to happen in Texas, in New Mexico?
Well, the single most important thing is to get parents to go to a vaccination center, their pediatrician, and get them vaccinated, because a single dose of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the MMR vaccine, is more than 90% protective. And by the way, if you've been recently exposed and you get the vaccine within 72 hours, you can actually prevent your child from getting severe measles, or maybe prevent the infection altogether. So the key is getting as many kids possible vaccinated in a catch-up campaign, and that's got to be the number one priority.
Dr. Hotez, I want to ask you another question. You were on an Ebola task force years ago. President Trump, yesterday's cabinet meeting, introduced a non-cabinet member to address the group. And of course, it was the world's wealthiest person. It was Elon Musk. This is what he had to say about Ebola.
And I should say, we will make mistakes. We won't be perfect. But when we make a mistake, we'll fix it very quickly. So, for example, with USAID, one of the things we accidentally canceled very briefly was Ebola, Ebola prevention. I think we all want Ebola prevention. So we restored the Ebola prevention immediately, and there was no interruption.
So they restored it immediately, and there was no interruption, says Elon Musk. I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post. Musk says DOGE restored Ebola prevention effort. Officials say that's not true. Can you explain what's going on here? I mean, with the evisceration of USAID, and what happens when CDC sends doctors for surveillance, for testing, and why doing that in countries, for example, in Africa, though it's important to do just for the people of Africa, why it affects us here at home as well?
You know, Amy, one of the most common questions I'm asked literally goes like this. You know, hey, doc, what the heck is going on? That's literally the question. When you're trying to figure out what they're trying to ask, what they really mean is, why are we seeing this regular cadence of pandemic and pandemic threats? We had severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS-1 in 2002, then H1N1, and then Ebola in 2014 in West Africa that hit Dallas, Texas. I got involved in Governor Rick Perry's task force at that time. Then we had Zika in 2016, Ebola again, a devastating epidemic in East Congo in 2019, then SARS-2, COVID-19. We had Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. And the answer is, we think 21st century forces, which include climate change and urbanization and deforestation, we could do a whole hour discussion about why that promotes this steady rise of pandemics. This is one of our nation's greatest threats, and in my view, as important as military threats. And therefore, we've got to take biosecurity very seriously. And frankly, we're not. We're parading virologists in front of C-SPAN cameras to try to accuse them of COVID origins and this kind of nonsense, when we know that the SARS-2 COVID arose just like the original SARS did. We denigrate what the good work of USAID does, and we can't do that. We are so vulnerable right now to the next wave of pandemics, including possibly another coronavirus, as well as filoviruses like Ebola. And we've got this thing, Amy, in case you don't know it, H5N1, right? Which is accelerating across the cattle and the wild birds and the poultry in the United States. We've got to buckle down and take this seriously, and we're just not.
So I have two quick questions, and we just have a minute. Can you comment on the FDA canceling a meeting of vaccine experts scheduled to advise on flu shots, the significance of this cancellation?
Yeah, that's a head scratcher. You know, the making the flu vaccine each year is a carefully orchestrated dance, because it involves three different virus strains, two influenza A types, H1N1, H3N2, and an influenza B. To get it right, we have to start meeting in February in order to tell the manufacturers which specific vaccine strains to make in order to have it ready by September. So the manufacturers need to know that now, and that's done through consultation meetings based at the World Health Organization, which ordinarily CDC would be invited to, but now we've pulled out of the WHO. And then we bring it to the US FDA in case there's any tweaks that need to be made to specifically to benefit the U.S. population. So by canceling that meeting, it just shoots ourselves in the foot. It's inexplicable.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, we talked about Ebola, but do you know about this mysterious illness in Eastern DRC? World Health Organization, which Trump has pulled us out of, says it's not Marburg or Ebola, likely came from a bat. Could it be a novel virus? So far, 419 cases, 53 deaths.
You know, the DR Congo is a very interesting place because you do have that mix of bats, which carry both coronaviruses and filoviruses, as well as deforestation and populations encroaching on those forested areas. And so this is why we see so many viruses emerge out of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so the surveillance, again, CDC has an active presence there. We have U.S. scientists at universities, like my good friend and colleague, Dr. Anne Ramoyne, has a group there. And this is why we need to maintain our vigilance, because there's new viruses emerging on a regular basis.
And again, just to correct myself, that was in West DRC, not in East. Dr. Peter Hotez, thanks so much for being with us, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine, Professor of Pediatrics and Molecular Virology and Microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine, co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development, author of several books, including The Deadly Rise of Anti-Science, A Scientist's Warning. Coming up, we're going to talk more about Elon Musk. But first, Lebanon after Nasrallah. We'll go to Sharif Abdelkaddous in southern Lebanon. Stay with us. By Yasmin Hamdan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's new government won a confidence vote in parliament Wednesday with the backing of 95 lawmakers in the 128-seat chamber. Prime Minister Nawaz Salam was appointed last month to form a government in the wake of Israel's war on Lebanon that killed over 4,000 people and displaced over 1.2 million. Hezbollah's bloc and parliament backed the new government Wednesday, even though the statement that was adopted notably said only Lebanon's armed forces should defend the country. It also did not include the phrase, quote, armed resistance, which is usually seen as legitimizing Hezbollah's possession of weapons outside state control. On a visit to Lebanon earlier this month, U.S. Deputy Middle East Envoy Morgan Ortegas said the inclusion of Hezbollah in the Lebanese government was a, quote, red line. Hezbollah has long been one of the strongest forces in the region fighting Israel. Hezbollah's longtime leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed in September, and the group also lost many of its top commanders in rank and file. Under a ceasefire agreement, Israel withdrew its troops from southern Lebanon last week, but it continues to illegally occupy five locations inside Lebanon. Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous traveled to Lebanon last week to report from the ground in the south and to cover Nasrallah's funeral, one of the biggest in the region in decades. He filed this report for Dropsite News and Democracy Now!
Southern Lebanon, scenes of utter devastation. This is the village of Kfar Kila, or what is left of it after the Israeli military finally withdrew its forces on February 18th. Israel's war in Lebanon lasted for well over a year. Hezbollah began firing rockets and artillery at Israeli forces one day after Israel began its genocidal assault on Gaza. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah called it a solidarity front with the Palestinians. Israel retaliated by bombing Lebanon, mostly in the south, the heartland of Hezbollah's power base, before escalating dramatically in September, carpet bombing large swaths of the country and launching a ground invasion. But much of the destruction in these villages in the south came during a so-called ceasefire that went into effect on November 27th. During that time, occupying Israeli troops use bulldozers, dynamite, and artillery to flatten entire areas.
We're standing here on the rubble of one of the homes. There's hardly any structures that have been left standing. The Israeli military left here just 3 days ago, occupying the village for several months. Residents were trying to get back to their homes, were protesting on the outskirts, but there's hardly anyone here because there's nothing to come back to. You can see we're just on the border with Palestine. There's the wall. Israeli settlements are there in the distance. But the village has been demolished. There's concrete, twisted rebar, the remnants of life, but no one is here.
Along with the destruction, Israeli troops left behind clear signs of their presence. Graffiti scrawled in Hebrew on this home reads, "So-and-so is here," with the name blacked out. A 20-minute drive northeast from Kfar Kila lies the town of Chiem. While some buildings are still standing, residents say as much as 70% of Chiem has been destroyed. Hezbollah mounted a fierce resistance here, preventing the Israeli military from invading and occupying it. When the ceasefire agreement went into effect in late November and the fighters withdrew, Israeli tanks and troops poured in.
They only came into Chiem during the 60-day ceasefire. That's when they came into Chiem and destroyed 50% of Chiem during that time, using detonation. It was only during the ceasefire.
Ali Khris is a local resident who runs a small cafe in Chiem. His son Mehdi, a 33-year-old father of two, was a fighter who was killed on October 29, 2024.
My son is one of the resistance fighters. He is one of the ones who remained here and fought here and was martyred here. And it was through their blood that we returned to our town. They decided that we wouldn't return to our lands, but we did return through the blood of our martyrs who sacrificed for us. Now the town is empty, but we are trying as much as we can. We will return to our lands for sure. We have more than 30, 40, 50 families who have already returned, and they are staying here, but on the outskirts of the town, because in the middle of the town, there are hardly any houses left standing.
Israel's onslaught on Chiem even extended to the local cemetery, which the Israeli military shelled. Rubble litters the tombstones, some of which have been split apart and broken open. Among the graves damaged is that of Assam Abdullah, the 37-year-old journalist working for Reuters, who was killed by Israeli tank fire in a targeted attack on October 13, 2023. The white headstone bearing an image of his face was broken nearly in half. Since November, Israel has violated the ceasefire in Lebanon hundreds of times. While we're in the southern village of Houla, the Israeli military attacked a civilian car on the outskirts of town, setting it on fire with black smoke visible on an adjacent hilltop. We also met Houla native Ibrahim Yassin as he was placing a picture of his martyred son on the rubble.
This point where I'm standing exactly is where my son was martyred. My son, the martyr, is Muhammad Ibrahim Yassin. And it was here that he was killed. And if it wasn't for this pure blood, this country would not have been liberated. The enemy is still in five locations. Sooner or later, they will withdraw, whether they want to or not, as long as they are men who will fight.
Like many thousands of others from the south, Ibrahim was traveling to Beirut to attend the funeral of former Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah.
This historical figure was bringing the nation together, the history of the nation. He brings all the people together. He didn't just defend the South. He defended Palestine. He defended Gaza, Iraq, Yemen. He defended all of the oppressed people.
The funeral of Hassan Nasrallah on February 23rd was a major regional event. As Hezbollah's leader for over 30 years, Nasrallah helped transform the group from a militia into one of the most powerful political movements in the Arab world and a formidable fighting force in the region. He was killed in September when Israel dropped more than 80 tons of munitions on a residential compound in Beirut's southern suburb of Dahiya, also killing an unknown number of civilians.
A
massive turnout today in Beirut for the funeral of Hassan Nasrallah, with tens of thousands of people taking to the streets. This is a show of presence and of support for Hezbollah, which suffered heavy losses in Israel's war on Lebanon, including the loss of Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader for more than 30 years, as well as many top commanders and its rank and file. Nasrallah was buried in a secret grave after he was killed nearly 5 months ago. When his body was brought today, there was open displays of emotion, men and women weeping for the loss of this leader. At some point, Israeli jets flew low overhead, prompting the crowd to chant against Israel, to chant against the United States. This is the biggest funeral in Lebanon in decades, and it's a show of Hezbollah's political and military presence in the future of Lebanon.
On Monday, a funeral ceremony was held for Hashem Safieddine, Nasrallah's cousin and successor, who was killed a few days after Nasrallah. While a far smaller turnout than the ceremony honoring Nasrallah, it was nevertheless a significant event. The entire town came to pay tribute, with a marching band and young men in uniform holding Hezbollah flags amidst thousands of mourners who took to the streets. Among those who came to attend was senior Hezbollah official and member of parliament, Ibrahim al-Mousawi. For security reasons, he left quickly after paying his respects, but we caught up with them that evening in Beirut.
Yesterday there was a massive funeral for Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. We saw a very big turnout. In addition to mourning Nasrallah, was this also a show of strength by Hezbollah?
First of all, you're talking about a whole society community that is completely devoted and dedicated to the idea, to the concept of the resistance. Because we live in a part of the world where the world conspiracy, if you want, the world hegemony, the occupation, the expansionist tendency of the Israeli enemy is there always, all of the time. Part of our land has been occupied, and part of our land has already been occupied also after this war. So you're talking more or less about people who are under occupation, who are under oppression, who are under continuous target aggression from the Israeli side, supported by the Americans. And yesterday, you know, they said, we have done with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been destroyed. To their shock and to their surprise, you're talking about one of the unprecedented rallies in the history of Lebanon and maybe in the region. If you take it proportionally, you will see that when you have more than 1 million people marching into the streets to mourn their leader, to send a message of strength, a message of solidarity, a message of assistance, a message of support, a message of belief, a message of loyalty, a message of faithfulness to the resistance, then this tells you who has been the loser, actually.
The Trump administration has said that Hezbollah being a part of the Lebanese government is a red line. What's your response to that?
Look, when we talk about democracy, we talk about the free choices of the people. We are constituency, we are part and bulk of this community. When you believe in democracy, is it like a decontextualized democracy, democracy here, not democracy there? I mean, who is Trump to dictate his policies upon us? Who has given him the right to say what's right and what's wrong? Who has given him the right to say what are the red lines and what are the green lines? It's a red line for Trump and for all of the dictators and the hegemons of the world to dictate their policies upon us or upon any free, independent society. So it's a red line for him to do it, and he's trespassing so many different red lines. This is something that has to do with his opinion. He can keep it for himself. While here we are an independent, sovereign country, we are an independent, sovereign society, and we have the right to exercise our rights in democracy and in being represented in the government and in the parliament and all the political life in the country.
Israel continues to occupy 5 positions inside Lebanon. If that occupation continues, will Hezbollah respond?
Yesterday, our Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasim, said that we're giving the opportunity for the government, for the international community, and we will observe what's really going on to happen. And after that, we will take the position and the decision that we feel necessary to protect our country.
With the loss of Nasrallah and much of its top leadership, Hezbollah has entered a new phase, one that will affect the future of Lebanon for years to come. For Democracy Now! And Dropsite News,
I'm Sherif Abdul Qudus with Lamal Aryan.
This special report was a Democracy Now! Collaboration with DropSite News. You can read all Sharif's reporting as well as DropSite's reports from inside Gaza, the West Bank, and elsewhere at DropSiteNews.com, as well as Sharif's reporting on DemocracyNow.org. Special thanks to Malak Hosni, Tarek Kubawi, and Ibrahim Ali for that report. Sherif Abdelkaddous won a George Polk Award for his Al Jazeera documentary on the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. Sherif's documentary for Al Jazeera's Fault Lines, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, has been nominated for a Royal Television Society Award in Britain. The award ceremony is March 5th in London. Coming up, Donald Trump holds his first cabinet meeting. We'll look at the role of OMB director, architect of Project 2025, Russell Vogt. Back in 30 seconds. This is not a scene, it's a pyramid scheme. This is not a joke, there's a hole in the board. And you could paint your portal on the wall with the intention to break. Pyramid Scream, the Pyramid Scheme, the latest single by Hooray for the Riff Raff. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump held his first cabinet meeting Wednesday in a usual move for the first official to address the meeting after the president was not a member of the cabinet, but Elon Musk, the world's richest man, who's been the public face of the administration's effort to dismantle many government agencies and slash the size of the federal workforce. This is Trump introducing Musk Wednesday.
So I'd like to have Elon Musk please say a few words.
Okay. Thank you, Elon.
Thank you, Mr. President. I actually just call myself a humble tech support here because this is actually, as crazy as it sounds, that is almost a literal description of the work that the DOGE team is doing, is helping fix the government computer systems.
Elon Musk went on to claim DOGE is aiming to slash $1 trillion in spending. During the meeting, he spoke three times as long as any member of Trump's cabinet. Some cabinet members didn't make any public remarks. This includes Budget Director Russell Vogt, who's seen by many as the architect behind Trump's radical moves to reshape the federal government. Vogt served in the same role as head of the Office of Management and Budget in the first Trump administration, then went on to author the right-wing Project 2025 playbook. This is a clip of Vogt during a 2023 speech he gave during a private gathering at the pro-Trump think tank Center for Renewing America. The video was obtained by ProPublica and documented. And here, Vogt's outlining his goal of defunding federal bureaucracies.
We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want, when they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down so that the EPA can't do all of the rules against our energy industry because they have no bandwidth financially to do so. We want to put them in trauma.
We're joined now by Branko Marcetic. He's a Jacobin staff writer where his recent piece is headlined, Russell Vogt Wants to Burn the Government Down. Branko, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, respond overall to this highly unusual cabinet meeting, and then talk about the role of Russell Vogt, who we don't usually see in front of the cameras, but who has played such a key role behind the scenes.
I mean, I think the cabinet meeting shows the tenor and direction of the Trump administration, which, you know, Trump had campaigned on kind of fighting for the forgotten American, for fighting for the working class. You know, he said that he was going to fight Washington corruption. And then before he'd even been inaugurated, we saw him basically handing over the reins of government, not just to Elon Musk, but a whole host of billionaires. And now, of course, you have 13 billionaires in cabinet positions running the government. You know, it's a complete betrayal, I think, of the people who voted for Trump in the vain hope that he was actually going to solve some of the problems that were bedeviling them, and you know, really, really gives to lie to this entire rhetoric that we've heard for the last few years. You know, with vote, I think it's interesting because Musk gets all the attention and deservedly so. But in many ways, you know, I liken Musk to kind of the private contractor or the consulting firm that's brought in to basically do the dirty work of the people in management. And that's Russell Vought. Vought's normally known as the Project 2025 guy. He's, you know, known as a Christian nationalist, a hardcore social conservative. All of that is true. But I think that the more important thing about Vought is kind of his entire career's history. And, you know, he's a guy who most accurately to describe it, he is an anti-government radical. He is someone who sees government as the biggest problem in people's lives. He sees everything that has been done basically since the Great Depression and the creation of the New Deal state that has lifted people out of poverty, that has made it so that people aren't being preyed on and poisoned and otherwise hurt by greed, by corporate greed. He sees all of that as a tremendous, profound mistake that needs to be reversed. And that has been his life's goal. He sees Medicaid and Social Security. He thinks these programs should be eliminated or privatized. He has actually spoken to Heritage, the Heritage Foundation. He said, I may not be into cutting Social Security and Medicare right now, but that's purely a strategic decision on my part. We want to basically start with the cuts that Americans will feel the least, things like foreign aid, and then eventually we will build up to the point where we can really take on these programs. You know, Vought is such a disbeliever in the importance of government and people's lives that he thinks even the construction and repair of roads and highways is illegitimate and dangerous for the government to do. And so this is really very much what's driving, I think, what we're seeing from Doge and a lot of these attempts to just completely dismantle the federal government. It's part of a long-standing political agenda of this man that I think does not line up with what the U.S. public wants. I think it doesn't really line up with a lot of what even Trump voters in this last election want.
Talk, Branko, about the memo that was distributed on Wednesday that, if you can continue to say, shocked so many, that directs agencies to submit their reduction in force plans by March 13th. It's not just about laying off employees. And also, I mean, the bigger picture is the amount of money that goes that the federal budget goes to federal workers is tiny. If you're talking about saving money, the fact that they're focusing completely there on these 2.3 million federal workers who are in such agony right now. Tell us about the memo.
I mean, that shows you, the entire game. It's not really about saving money. Spending cuts and the deficit have been used by Vought, not just Vought, many right-wing voices over the years as excuses to try and basically dismantle the modern administrative state. That's what they want to do. That's what Vought has been pretty open about wanting to do. And so, you know, using the deficit is just an excuse. Vought's budgets that he made both in when he was serving in the House and also now when he was heading the Center for Renewing America, at the same time as they make these ruthless cuts to the programs that people rely on, a call for the mass firing of federal workers, they also want to keep in place massive tax cuts for the rich that Trump passed. And this was the same thing back in the 2000s when Vought's mock budgets kept in place Bush's tax cuts. So the idea here behind that memo is to start dismantling and make these agencies basically dysfunctional, because that in itself is going to help create the groundwork for further dismantling and possible privatization in the future. If government becomes dysfunctional, if it seemed to not work, if it doesn't seem like it's actually serving the interests of people, then you can kind of come through and say, well, look at that. The fact is, government doesn't work. We should just sell this off to private corporations and let them do it. Mm. That's what Vote has wanted to do with the Postal Service, for instance, for many years. There was reporting also that they're going to be starting to slash workers from the Social Security Administration. To me, I think that's clearly a attempt by stealth to start to undermine Social Security. They can say, well, we're not going to cut it now. We're going to do as Trump is saying and leave it alone. But what they're basically aiming to do is to make the Social Security program function badly, so that down the line, a few years from now, when, you know, J.D. Vance is president or whoever else, they can say, well, look how bad this is working now that we've fired all these people. This should just be privatized as we wanted to do 20 years ago.
And of course, if you're talking about privatizing the Postal Service or Trump taking over the U.S. Postal Service, that also has a great impact on voting. But I want to ask you about the Washington Post reporting. The Federal Aviation Administration's close to canceling a $2.4 billion contract with Verizon and awarding the work to Elon Musk's Starlink. The contract is for work to overhaul a key communication system in nation's air traffic control system. Meanwhile, a separate investigation by the Washington Post has revealed Musk has built his business empire on $38 billion in federal funding via government contracts, loans, subsidies, and tax credits over the past two decades. And the Post reports the total number might be even higher because it's not known how much Musk companies has received in classified work for the Pentagon and other agencies, not to mention he pushed out the head of the FAA, right, in charge of aviation. We've had one accident after another. He pushed him out because he didn't like he would be fined and also was raising questions about his rockets bursting in air over places like Turks and Caicos. Bronco.
I mean, I don't know what other word you can use for this other than corruption. It's, you know, Washington has long been a place where donors end up getting a tremendous amount of say over government policy, where they are able to use that to push their own business interests. Both parties do it. It's frustration with that, I think, is one of the reasons why Trump won in 2016 and why he continues to have appeal with people when he says he's going to take on the swamp and Washington corruption. And yet here we have the Trump administration engaging in the exact same kind of corruption and swamp-like behavior that it claims to be fighting, except on overdrive. I mean, I don't think that we have ever seen anything quite this naked before, where the world's richest man gives a campaign $280 million, and then is basically just a role is carved out for him. He's not even confirmed by any elected officials, and is allowed to just basically go through and start dismantling things from the inside, while also then fattening his own pockets from the same public money that he claims that he is trying to root out waste and fraud from. I mean, it's pretty astounding.
Bronco,
I don't think we've seen anything like this before.
In this last minute we have, I want to ask you about Ukraine. Ukrainian President Zelensky headed to Washington, D.C., will sign a deal at the White House on Friday, giving the U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals and other resources. Trump was asked about Ukraine during his first cabinet meeting.
Well, I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much. We're going to have Europe do that because it's in, you know, we're talking about Europe is their next door neighbor. But we're going to make sure everything goes well. And as you know, we'll be making a we'll be really partnering with Ukraine in terms of rare earth. We very much need rare earth. They have great rare earth. We'll be working with Secretary Burgum and with Chris, you'll be working on that together.
Bronco Marchetich, your final comment. We just have 30 seconds.
You know, I think this continues the plundering of Ukraine that has been going on. It's been bipartisan policy for years now. To use deepening U.S. military involvement in the country and economic dependence on the United States as a way to get Ukraine to do a host of damaging neoliberal reforms that are contrary to the interests of the actual Ukrainian people. And this is just, you know, again, it's that on overdrive.
Branko Marcegic, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Jacobin staff writer speaking to us from Chicago. We'll link to all your recent articles at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh Marie.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Oh dear, what can the matter be, dear, dear? What can the matter be, oh dear? What can the matter be, Johnny, so long at the fair? Now he promised to buy me a bunch of blue ribbons, he promised to buy me a bunch of blue ribbons. He promised to buy me a bunch of blue ribbons to tie up my bonny brown hair. Well, what